You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry Incorporated as a service to God's people. This is message number 1 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. The first message is entitled, Four Jewish Youths in a Pagan Culture.
The Book of Daniel is one of the most significant prophetic books in all the Word of God. As Daniel received revelation from the Lord, he spelled out many events that would transpire centuries beyond Daniel's day. Some of those events have already taken place and are now completed history. But a number of those prophetic events which Daniel foretold have not yet taken place. Their fulfillment awaits the future beyond the time that you and I are now living. The theme of the book of Daniel is the sovereignty of God. We're going to see this demonstrated again and again. The fact that Jehovah, the God of Israel, the Most High God, the true and the living one, is the one who is sovereign over the universe, over the world, in the affairs of men. This theme of the sovereignty of God is introduced to us in the key verse of the book of Daniel, and many are convinced that key verse is found in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. Daniel chapter 4, verse 17, where this is said to us. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones. In order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. An angel is declaring that Jehovah, the God of Israel, the Most High God, is ruler over the affairs of men in this world. And he is the one who determines who will be the human leaders of human beings on the stage of world history. Chapter 1 of the book of Daniel serves as a historical introduction to all the rest of the book. It sets the stage for everything else that will transpire from chapters 2 through 12. It tells us how Daniel and his three Hebrew companions were carried from their homeland of Israel over to the land of Babylon, and how they were incorporated into the service of mighty King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, at that particular time. So chapter 1 of Daniel is the historical introduction to the entire book. And as we move through chapter 1, we shall discover that this chapter has four major divisions to it. The first division is in verses 1 and 2, which we could entitle Nebuchadnezzar's First Expedition to Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar's First Expedition to Jerusalem. The second section of chapter 1 is found in verses 3 through 7, which we could entitle Daniel and his three Jewish friends. Here is where they are introduced to us. The third division is found in verses 8 through 16, which we could entitle the abstention of Daniel and his friends. We shall see that Daniel and his friends determined that they would abstain from certain things that the king had given to them to partake of. The abstention of Daniel and his friends. And then the fourth and final division of chapter 1 is found in verses 17 through verse 21. And this we could entitle the progress of the four Jewish youths. The progress of the four Jewish youths. Now let's begin with the first section of chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar's first expedition to Jerusalem, found in verses 1 and 2. This is what we read. In the year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. The drums of war were beating in the Middle East. The two great superpowers of that day, namely Egypt and Babylon, were vying with each other for control of the entire Middle Eastern area. And it was only a matter of time until those two great powers would have an all-out clash with each other to determine who would indeed be the one who would control that strategic area of the world. And sure enough, that all-out battle came in the summer of 605 B.C., when the armies of Babylon and Egypt were lined up confronting with each other outside a city called Carchemish that was located many, many miles north of the land of Israel. This battle of Carchemish raged for more than one day, and it was an extremely bloody battle with heavy losses suffered by both armies. But the final outcome of the battle was that Babylon defeated Egypt, and the Egyptian forces that remained were forced to retreat south from Carchemish through the land of Israel back to their homeland in Egypt. The man who was heading the Babylonian army was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, at this particular time in the summer of 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar was not yet the king of the land of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, was the king of that great Gentile power. This meant then that Nebuchadnezzar at this particular moment was the crown prince. He was the heir to the throne, who eventually would succeed his father as the king of this great Babylonian empire. Now that Egypt had been handed a sound defeat by the Babylonians, and the Egyptians had withdrawn down to their homeland, this meant that the land of Palestine, where the Israeli nation was located, was wide open to Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylonian forces. And so in the summer of 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar marched his Babylonian troops south into the land of Israel, and he began to take control of the Jewish people and incorporate the land of Israel into his growing Babylonian empire. Obviously, one of the key centers to which Nebuchadnezzar wanted to come to claim his rule over the land of Israel would be the Jewish capital city of Jerusalem. And so, in July of 605 B.C., as we have recorded for us in verses 1 and 2 of Daniel chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar, the crown prince of Babylon, arrives at the Jewish capital city of Jerusalem. He makes a triumphal entry into that city as now the conqueror and controller of the Jewish people. But Nebuchadnezzar wasn't in Jerusalem very long. For on August 15th or 16th, 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, the king of Babylon, died very unexpectedly. And here was the crown prince hundreds of miles away from the capital city of Babylon. Back in these days of Oriental intrigue, if the successor to the throne wanted to claim that throne, he had better get there in a hurry, because there would be many other people who would have designs upon that throne. And so as soon as Nebuchadnezzar, over in Jerusalem, received word that his father had died, he decided to rush home to Babylon as fast as he could get there to claim the throne and become the new king of that great Gentile empire. But when Nebuchadnezzar returned home, he did not go alone. Both the biblical account and ancient Babylonian records record the fact that Nebuchadnezzar took to Babylon with him some of the prime young men of the Jewish nation. Many of them were young men from the royal family and also from the noble families of the land of Israel. And among those prime Jewish young men who were carried captive to Babylon were Daniel and three of his closest friends. They are named for us later on in chapter 1. But Nebuchadnezzar not only took some of the Jewish young men with him to Babylon, but we also read in verse 2 that he took with him the sacred vessels, or some of the sacred vessels of Jehovah, from the temple of God that Solomon had built in the city of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar carried those sacred vessels of Jehovah as well captive to the land of Babylon. And we're told here that he brought those vessels of Jehovah to the house of his God, to the temple of his Babylonian God. Now the Babylonians at this time worshipped many different gods. They were polytheists. In light of that, obviously the statement that Nebuchadnezzar brought the vessels of Jehovah to the house of his God would mean that he brought these vessels of Jehovah to the temple of the chief god of the whole Babylonian structure of gods and goddesses that those people worship. And ancient Babylonian records tell us who that chief Babylonian god was. His name was Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. And so when Nebuchadnezzar arrives home to Babylon to claim the throne, he takes these captured sacred vessels of Jehovah and he places them into the pagan temple of the chief god of the Babylonians, the god Marduk. Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar do that? Well, certainly, one of the reasons that ancient kings would take the sacred vessels of gods of conquered peoples to their homeland was because those sacred vessels were extremely valuable. And this was certainly true of the sacred vessels of Jehovah. Most of them were made out of pure gold. And Nebuchadnezzar recognized the extreme value of those vessels. But there was a second and even greater reason why he took those vessels of Jehovah and placed them into the temple of his God. This was a way of a conqueror degrading and shaming the God of the people whom he had just conquered. For you see, in ancient times, to the pagan way of thinking, if one nation could conquer another nation, this was an indicator that the God of the conqueror was greater and more powerful than the God of the conquered people. And so it was the custom of ancient conquerors to take sacred vessels of the gods of the people whom they had conquered and put them in the temple of their God as a thank offering to their God, as their way of saying, I thank you for enabling me to conquer these people, but also as a way of defaming and degrading or putting down the God of their conquered people. This was Nebuchadnezzar's way then of saying to Jehovah, the God of Israel, my God Marduk is supreme to you. You are not the sovereign God of this world, but my God is. That's why I was able to conquer you. Please take note of this, because this was going to give Jehovah, the God of Israel, a splendid opportunity of demonstrating not only to this pagan Gentile king, but to the whole known world at that time, that in spite of the fact that he had allowed his people to be conquered by pagan Gentiles, in no way was that a sign that he was inferior to any other god or that he had been conquered by a pagan god. This was going to afford Jehovah, the God of Israel, a tremendous opportunity to display the fact, I am the sovereign Lord of this universe, in spite of the fact that I have permitted my people to be conquered by you. Now this brings us to the second division of Daniel chapter 1, Daniel and his companions. And here they are introduced to us in verses 3 through 7. We read, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Daniel and his 3 Jewish companions are introduced. You'll note in verse 3 that after the Jewish young men who had been carried captive by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon arrived there in this foreign land, the king commands that the cream of the crop of these young men be taken and placed into a special training school. A training school in which they would be equipped eventually to enter into the king's personal service. It was the design of Nebuchadnezzar that after these young men had received at least a partial amount of this unique training, that eventually they would appear before the king himself, for the king to observe them, but also for the king to give them qualifying examinations, to question them intensely to see how sharp they were in their intellect and how much they had learned, and were they capable of serving the king effectively in his service. One of the questions that is often asked of Daniel and his companions is this: how old were these young men when they were uprooted from their homeland and their families and their familiar surroundings and carried hundreds of miles into a completely foreign land and strange culture and environment? The word that is translated youths in verse 4 indicates that Daniel and his companions were anywhere from 15 to 20 years of age at this particular time. In other words, they were teenagers when they were uprooted from their homeland and carried captive to the land of Babylon. Teenagers are very impressionable. And I'm certain that was true of Daniel and his companions. They were placed into a training school under a group of men who were called the Chaldeans, according to verse 4. Now, in the land of Babylon at this time, the word Chaldean was used in 2 different ways. First, it was used in a broad sense to refer to all Babylonians. And so if you read ancient literature, very frequently you will find all the Babylonian people called Chaldeans. But then that term was used in a more narrow sense within the nation of Babylon itself to refer to a very elite, special corps of intellectuals in the land of Babylon. These were the famed wise men of the East. They themselves had received the greatest education that was available on the face of the earth at this time, and they themselves were the educators. They were also the priests of the Babylonian pagan worship system at this time. And because they were the elite intellects, ultimately they were the great power in the land of Babylon. Some of the ancient Babylonian records indicate that even the kings of Babylon themselves were frequently derived from this elite corps of intellectual scholars. Daniel and his companions are now put into training under the top intellects of the ancient world. And Nebuchadnezzar commanded that they were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The word literature literally means the writings. This means that they were to be taught not just what we normally call literature today, but they were to be taught every area of knowledge that these Chaldean scholars had put into writing. for the people of their time. Ancient Babylonian records tell us the different subjects that were taught by the Chaldeans in this training school. Daniel and his companions would have been taught astronomy, the study of the heavens, the movements of the planets, the galaxies, etc. But in addition, they were also taught astronomy in this school, something which God had forbidden Jewish people to get absorbed in, because God himself is opposed to astronomy. The idea that the movements of the heavenly bodies control the destiny of human beings and nations. But Daniel and his companions were required to be exposed to that area of thinking by these Babylonian priest scholars. They were also taught agriculture and Babylonian architecture. They were taught the Babylonian mythology that was associated with the pagan religions of ancient Babylon. They were taught different forms of mathematics. They were taught natural history. In other words, the history of nature in the world, earth history. And finally, they were to be taught the many different languages that these priest scholars of the Babylonian Empire were very knowledgeable in. Great curriculum, in a sense, that these young men were to be exposed to, but some of the subject matter was anti-Jehovah, or anti the God of Israel. They were to be molded and shaped in the Babylonian mindset of the day. This was one of the key reasons for Nebuchadnezzar commanding these young men to be trained by the top scholars of the Babylonian Empire. We find when we come to verse 5 that Nebuchadnezzar decided that these young men, not just the Jewish young men, but all the other conquered young men who were in his special training school, were to eat the same foods and drink the same wine that the king himself consumed. Now again, ancient historical records indicate that this was customary for ancient Oriental kings. And it was regarded as a special privilege that those who were in the king's service, those who were already in that service or were being trained to take part in that service, would be allowed to eat the same delicacies, the same foods, and drink the same wines as the king himself. Nebuchadnezzar commanded that these kind of foods and drinks were to be given to these young scholars. But then in verses 6 and 7, we find that the Babylonians did an interesting thing with Daniel and his companions. They decided to change their names from Jewish names to Babylonian names. Again, there was a reason for that. You see, the Jewish names that Daniel and his companions had were names that honored Jehovah, the God of Israel. For instance, the name Daniel literally meant God is judge. The name Hananiah meant Jehovah is gracious. The name Mishael meant who is what God is, designed to emphasize the fact that there is no one else like Jehovah, the God of Israel. And the name Azariah meant Jehovah has helped. But the Babylonians didn't want these young men who may eventually enter into the king's service having Jewish names that would honor the God that they felt that they had just humiliated in conquering his people. And so, in order to squeeze these young men more into the Babylonian mold, they changed their names to Babylonian names that, interestingly, would honor the gods of Babylon. For instance, Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. That name literally means Bel protect. Bel was one of the key gods worshipped by the ancient Babylonians in their religious system. Hananiah's name was changed to Shadrach, which literally means command of Aku, A-K-U. Aku was the moon god that the ancient Babylonians worshipped at this time. Mishael's name, remember his name meant who is what God is, was changed to Meshach, and that Babylonian name meant who is what Aku is. Just the opposite of Mishael. And again, the implication is there is no other god like Aku, the Babylonian moon god. And then Azariah's name was changed to Abednego. Most scholars are convinced that in the original scriptures that Daniel wrote that it was actually Abednego, N-E-B-O, rather than N-E-G-O. And one of the reasons they are convinced that that's what the original scriptures had is because one of the key gods in the Babylonian worship system was a god by the name of Nebo. And so the name Abednego meant slave of Nebo. The idea being to this Jewish young man, formerly you were the slave of the servant of Jehovah, but no more are you to be the slave of Jehovah. Now you are to be the slave or the servant of Nebo, one of the chief Babylonian gods. Some interesting changes that were transpiring in the lives of these Jewish young men. I'd like to point out some observations of what was happening here. I'd like to point out the fact that there were approximately 10 pressure points being brought to bear at this time upon these Jewish young men. And every one of these 10 pressure points would have a tendency to squeeze these Jewish young men into the pagan Babylonian mold and to force them to forget their Jewish heritage and their worship and devotion to Jehovah, the God of Israel. Here are the 10 pressure points. For one thing, these Jewish young men now belong to a conquered, humiliated people. Their nation had just been conquered by the mighty Babylonians and thereby had been humiliated. And for young people, that's a shameful experience. And there'd be a natural tendency, in no way do I want to be identified anymore with my national heritage and my people since it has been conquered and humiliated. I'd sooner be identified with the mighty, with the conqueror. Second pressure point brought to bear upon them, they had been uprooted from their families, from their friends, from their familiar surroundings, from everything that had been meaningful to them in the past and had given them stability. When that happens in a person's life, a tendency again is to change drastically under those kind of circumstances. Third pressure point brought to bear upon them was this. They were now placed into a totally strange environment and culture that they had never been exposed to before in all their lives. They were now total strangers in this new land to which they had been carried. Again, under those circumstances, there is a natural tendency to begin conforming to the new environment and to the new culture. Fourth pressure point, now that they were in the land of Babylon, they were a very small minority. As long as they were living in their homeland, they were part of the majority. But now they're foreigners in a foreign land, which meant that they were a small minority. And again, that brings tremendous pressure upon an individual to begin conforming to the majority who are living all around. A fifth pressure point that we have observed is they were teenagers. Teenagers are very concerned about peer pressure, wanting to be accepted by the in-group and recognized by the in-group as someone significant. And here they were, as teenagers, carried to a strange land. They're the minority. But because of the normal tendency of teenagers to conform to peer pressure, again, this would be a tremendous pressure point upon them to begin conforming to the Babylonian ways, to the Babylonian thinking, in order to be accepted by their conquerors and their new rulers. A sixth pressure point brought to bear upon them, their God had been greatly humiliated. After all, his sacred vessels had been carried with him to the land of Babylon. They probably observed the sacred vessels of their god being put into the temple of Marduk, the chief Babylonian god. And that would have been a very humiliating experience for those young men. In light of that, there would have been a tendency to say, forget that God. If he's not powerful enough to preserve our nation from foreign conquerors, we are done with him. It'd be a normal tendency to begin looking to the gods of the conquerors and to adopt them as the new gods to worship and to obey. A seventh pressure point, they were placed under the instruction of godless teachers. If there's anything I've learned as a teacher, is the tremendous influence that teachers have upon young students in molding and shaping their minds. It is a scary thing, believe me. And here were the elite scholars of the day. And here are these young men being placed under them. Young people are tremendously impressed very frequently by scholarly teachers. And this would have been a normal, natural tendency for Daniel and his companions again to begin thinking the way these men think. If they are the elite scholars of the day, then they must have everything put together right. And I want to think the way they think. And I want my lifestyle to be like their lifestyle. But notice, these were godless teachers. These were pagan men who had no concept or proper understanding of the true and the living God, Jehovah, the God of Israel. An eighth pressure point brought to bear upon them, these young men were taught, in some instances, anti-God subjects. Astronomy being one of those subjects to which God was very definitely opposed. Ninth, as we've just noted, their names were changed from names honoring their God to names honoring the Babylonian gods. This again would have a tendency to make them begin acting differently. It was designed to do that, to make them forget their Jewish heritage and their God and begin conforming to the Babylonian mindset. And a tenth pressure point ties in with the ninth one. This name change very deftly implied that they were under the rule, the thumb of the Babylonians. If somebody's got the authority to change your name, that implies you are under the dominion of that individual. All of these pressure points would have had a normal, natural tendency to squeeze these Jewish young men into the Babylonian pagan lifestyle and mold, and to forget Jehovah, the true and the living God, and their Jewish heritage from back in the land of Israel. They are under tremendous pressure. And it was only a matter of time until a test was going to come to see, would they conform to the world system that was dominating them, or would they remain true in their obedience to their God? In spite of the fact that it looked as if their God had been conquered by the Babylonian gods. And sure enough, the test came. And this brings us to the third division of chapter 1, the abstention of Daniel and his friends. We just noted in verse 5 that King Nebuchadnezzar had appointed that these young scholars were to eat the king's food and drink the king's wine. And that posed a problem for these Jewish young men. In fact, there probably was a twofold problem for them. Number one is, you know, if you know anything of the Old Testament scriptures, God under the law had forbidden the Jews to eat certain kinds of food. It would make them ceremonially unclean and therefore not fit to come into the presence of God to worship him. The pagan Gentiles had no such restrictions. Certainly the king would have eaten some of the foods that were forbidden to the Jews under the law. And since these young men were to eat the king's food, this would mean that they would now be required to eat some of those forbidden foods. Daniel and his companions had a decision to make. Shall we obey the king? Or shall we obey God? When there is a conflict between what God commands and what the ruler commands. But there was a second problem that they had, and this we learn from secular records of ancient Babylon. The king's food, before it would be served to the Babylonian king, would be taken to one of the pagan Babylonian temples and first offered up as a pagan sacrifice to one of the Babylonian gods. To the Babylonian way of thinking, any person who ate any of the king's food that had been offered up as a sacrifice to the Babylonian god would thereby be participating in the worship of that pagan Babylonian god. That's exactly what the ancient Babylonians believed. And so if Daniel and his companions were to have eaten the king's food, they would thereby have given a clear-cut impression to the Babylonian people around them, we have now forsaken our God Jehovah, and we have begun to participate in the worship of the pagan Babylonian gods. Now there was a question of testimony before a pagan world on behalf of Jehovah. And once again, Daniel and his companions were faced with a decision. Shall we ruin our testimony for God? And shall we, in essence, by our action of eating the king's food, announce to the Babylonian world, we have forsaken our God and have adopted the worship of Jehovah? They made their decision. And thankfully, they made the right decision. In spite of these 10 pressure points brought to bear upon these teenage young men, to conform to the pagan Babylonian system, we are told, verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now let me point out some other observations here. These young men could have, as I'm afraid many of us as believers do today, have rationalized their way around disobedience to God. If they had wanted to, they could have rationalized this way. Who's going to know, at least among the people back home, if we eat the Babylonian king's food? We're away from home. Our parents aren't around to observe, nor our friends, nor the priests at Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. We are so many hundreds of miles away from home, what will it matter? Who will know if we disobey God on this count by eating the king's food? Well, they could have rationalized their way around obedience to God this way. God is to blame for these adverse circumstances in which we find ourselves. If God had not allowed the Babylonians to conquer us and carry us captive here, we wouldn't be forced to be making such a difficult decision as this. God is to blame for these circumstances, so therefore he's got to suffer the consequences of our disobedience. It's his fault if we disobey him, not ours. Or they could have rationalized their way around obedience to God this way. If we obey the king's command, then certainly we will be accepted into the king's service, and that will give us great influence as Jews in the government of Babylon. And after all, isn't that what God would want? Wouldn't he want his people to be in these influential positions so that they could perhaps influence the Babylonian king on behalf of the land of Israel? And so it's best if we obey this command of the king, even though by doing so we will violate God's command, because this will give us a golden opportunity to serve God in a more effective way on behalf of the land of Israel. Or they could have rationalized this way, if we disobey the king, then perhaps our lives will be taken. He may have us executed. Oriental kings at this time are very temperamental. If you looked at them cross-eyed, they'd just as soon lop off your head as let you continue living. And they could have reasoned, isn't in God's sight the continuation of our lives more important than obedience to just one simple principle or one simple command? We've got a lot of people reasoning that way today. A fifth way they could have rationalized their way around disobedience to God is, we're going to see that when they approached their immediate superior and asked permission to abstain from the king's food and be put on a different diet, this superior said to them, I would love to do that, but if when you have to appear before the king to be examined by him, he notices that you young men are not as healthy in appearance as the other young men, obviously he's going to start asking questions. Why are these young men more pale in appearance than the others? And we're going to have to answer, well, because they have not eaten your food, they have not drunk your wine as the others have. And right away he's going to recognize that we, who were in authority over you, disobeyed his command, and that will cost me my head. Daniel and his companions could have reasoned their way around the command of God by saying, if we really love that superior over us, then we will disobey the command of God in order to spare his life. And isn't that what love would dictate? Sparing his life, even though by doing so we have to violate an absolute of God. They could have reasoned their way around obedience to God's absolute command that way, but they didn't. They knew what God said. They knew it was an absolute that was binding upon them as Hebrew young men, and they knew that God requires absolute obedience of his people if they're going to love him and serve him as he desires. And so they made the decision. We must obey God rather than men, and let the consequences of that obedience to God rest in his hands. He's sovereign. He can take care of the consequences in a proper way. And so they took their stand. And they went to the superior, and please notice, they didn't go on a fanatical rampage in taking their stand. They didn't pick up the plate of the king's food when it was served to them and shove it in the face of the superior and say, I'm a follower of Jehovah, I won't touch this food. No, they went about it in a proper way, showing respect for authority over them, and they went to their immediate superior and they put in a special request. Allow us to abstain from the king's food. Give us just vegetables and water. And then when the superior said, but if we do that, it may cost me my life. If you appear more unhealthy than the other young men when you appear before the king, Daniel put in another legitimate request. Just give us a 10-day test. Give us vegetables and water for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, you examine us. If we are less healthy looking than the other young men, then you do with us whatever you see fit. But if we're more healthy, then there'll be no problem. And God worked in their superior's heart in such a way that he looked favorably upon these young men and their request, and he granted that request. They were put to the test for 10 days. Daniel and his companions were exhibiting tremendous faith in God. In essence, they were saying, all right, Lord, you gave the command. We're going to obey. We're walking out on a limb with you. We're expecting you to honor that request. If you want us to continue obeying your command, then we are trusting you to honor that request and make us more healthy in appearance than the other young men who partake of the king's food. And God honored their stand of faith. And at the end of the 10 days, they were more healthy in appearance. And therefore, the superior said, you are not required to eat the king's food. God honored their stand of faith. He's a sovereign God. And this brings us to the final division of chapter 1, verses 17 through 21, the progress of the Jewish youth. God not only honored their stand of faith by making them more healthy in appearance, but God gave to Daniel and his companions extra abilities in the intellectual realm to master the subjects that they were supposed to master in order to be in the king's service. To Daniel in particular, according to the end of verse 17, God gave the added ability of understanding and interpreting dreams and visions. That was very important in the land of Babylon, because the intellects of Babylon at this time put great stock in dreams and visions and their significance. And when Daniel and his companions were finally brought in, together with the other young men, before King Nebuchadnezzar for their qualifying exams, Daniel and his companions surpassed not only the fellow students, but even the scholars, their teachers, by 10 times in their wisdom, in their knowledge, and their ability. And as a result, Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed that he took those 4 Jewish young men and immediately placed them into his royal service, because he wanted these kind of young men aiding him, advising him, and serving him. God already was beginning to demonstrate that he is the sovereign God, and that he would honor the faith of young men who would stand true to him no matter what the cost. And the final testimony to God's sovereignty is at the end of verse 21. Remember again, this is a historical introduction, so here's a summary statement. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. Now, Cyrus the king was the Medo-Persian king who conquered Babylon eventually during Daniel's lifetime. Daniel continued to live even into the Medo-Persian rule, as we'll see later on, Lord willing, this week. But verse 21 is a summary statement, and all it's simply saying is this. In spite of all the intrigue that would take place in Oriental royal courts in ancient times, Daniel survived throughout all the history of that Babylonian empire. His life was not destroyed. He continued to survive through the whole course of the Babylonian empire's history. And the reason is because he was associated with the sovereign God of the universe, Jehovah, the God of Israel. Let's pray. God our Father, we praise you and thank you for who you are, together with your Son, Jesus Christ, and with the Holy Spirit. You are Jehovah, the true and the living God. You are the sovereign God of this entire universe. Lord, you demonstrated this again and again during the lifetime of your servant Daniel, back there in the 600s and 500s BC. We thank you that you demonstrate that again and again, even in this modern 20th century world in which we live. You are still the same God now as you were in Daniel's day. Because of that, those of us who are your people today through faith in Jesus Christ, pray that you will give us the grace and the strength for us to stand as Daniel and his companions did, as we also have a godless pagan world system all around us that increasingly desires to squeeze the people of God into its mold. May we as your people stand with the absolute truths that you've revealed in your word, and thereby afford you golden opportunities of demonstrating again and again who is the true and living and sovereign God of this universe. In Jesus' name, we ask and thank you for these things. Amen.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collingswood, New Jersey, 08107.